From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
What's disturbing to us is that experts are telling us that Russian state actors broke into the DNC, stole these emails, and other experts are now saying that the Russians are releasing these emails for the purpose of actually helping Donald Trump. I don't think it's coincidental that these emails were released on the eve of our convention.
That was Robbie Mook, then campaign manager for the 2016 presidential campaign of Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton back in July of 2016, announcing the beginning of what would come to be known as Russiagate, the claim that the Russian government hacked the DNC's computers and Hillary Clinton's private mail server and released material during the campaign intended to boost the position of then-candidate Donald Trump. It's taken more than 4 years since Mook made that announcement during the Democratic convention in 2016, but this past Tuesday, a letter was released from the Director of National Intelligence to the chair of a Senate committee investigating Russiagate, which confirmed that handwritten notes from former CIA Director John Brennan memorialized a briefing of former President Barack Obama on intelligence regarding allegations of, quote, approval by Hillary Clinton on July 26, 2016, of a proposal from one of her foreign policy advisors to vilify Donald Trump by stirring up a scandal claiming interference by Russian security services, closed quote. The letter from DNI John Ratcliffe to Senator Lindsey Graham as chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee further noted an investigative referral to former FBI Director James Comey and former deputy Peter Strzok regarding, quote, U.S. presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's approval of a plan concerning U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump and Russian hackers hampering U.S. elections as a means of distracting the public from her use of her private mail server, close quote. We will be following up this breaking story in subsequent newscasts. Up next, we have an interview that was done by Oksana Boyko, who's a journalist with RT, of Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, this past week, looking at the international scene from Tehran's perspective. This is excerpted from the program Worlds Apart from RT. And again, the interviewer is Oksana Boyko.
I want to start you by asking, how has this pandemic changed the workings of diplomacy? Do you guys have Zoom conversations like most of us, or is it deemed not particularly safe to exchange information this way?
Well, actually, we have to do that. And just this morning, I participated in the meeting of the Conference on Interaction and Cooperation in Asia, Confidence Building in Asia, via video conference. Mm-hmm. And there were some 20 more foreign ministers who were participating in that conference. And as you pointed out in your introductory statement, this virus doesn't recognize rich or poor, weak or strong, or enemies. It's affecting all of us. And it shows that we need to come together in order to fight this virus. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the United States continues to prevent Iran even from buying medicine and vaccine to buy this virus.
We will definitely discuss that in details, but let me ask you one more question about the workings of diplomacy, because from what you mentioned, I understand that when it comes to, you know, making public statements or prepared statements, it's okay to do it online, but you still came to Moscow for some reason. Is that because certain things are too sensitive to discuss?
Yeah, online? This is actually my third visit to Moscow after the corona breakout. So there are things that you need to discuss in person. Of course, we all use video conferencing, Zoom, or whatever other platforms that are available. But it comes to a point that you need to discuss certain things in person.
Mm-hmm. Now, under normal conditions, a diplomat of your stature would be granted full immunity. I mean, you cannot be searched, you cannot be tested. Has COVID-19 changed any of that? I mean, are you required, or do you require your peers, your counterparts, to provide some proof of them not being a health risk to others?
Well, we don't do that to diplomats in Iran, but and I was not subjected to any of those measures.
They didn't ask that in Moscow.
No, but in some other countries they do. Some countries require you to go through at least a temperature check. Some countries require you to provide them with a test that was taken no more than 48 hours before you arrived. But those are much fewer. China is, for instance, one of those countries that has very strict requirements. I'll be going to China in a couple of weeks, and it's not going to be easy.
Mm-hmm. Now, Iran is one of the hardest hit countries
yes.
in the Middle East. Some experts suggest that you are now in the grips of a third wave of the pandemic. And many high-ranking Iranian officials succumbed or even died from the virus. I know that one of your closest advisors and friends and former colleagues sadly died because of it. I wonder if you personally have developed any rules or routines to maximize your safety, because you are in a high-risk job. You have many interactions, so you are in a risk group for sure.
Well, we can only try to keep the necessary, not social distancing, but physical distance in our interactions, wear the mask.
You do wear the mask, because when you came in
here,
I
do. I do wear the mask. I do wear the mask all the time, and it's across the board. Mm-hmm. I wear the mask. All of my colleagues wear the mask. It's not as if I can be immune and they can have to wear the mask.
Now, you mentioned before that there are clear difficulties for Iran in securing medical equipment, and they were there even before the pandemic struck. How severe are they now, and is it a factor in why the pandemic affected your country so severely?
Well, certainly the sanctions and economic hardship that the United States imposed on Iran has had a significant impact on two levels. First, we could not keep people from going to work. We could not provide them with subsidies, with extra subsidies. We already do provide subsidies, but we couldn't provide them with extra subsidies or incentives to stay home. People had to earn a living, and the government's coffers were not that well filled. So we needed to allow them to earn their own living. This was the first decision that we had to make, a very hard decision, but a decision nevertheless that we needed to adopt. And secondly, the second level is buying medicine, buying the vaccine. The United States, first of all, limited our financial resources by preventing us from selling oil. And secondly, it is preventing us even from having access to our own money. Mm. We have quite a bit of money stashed in countries abroad, and those countries are prevented by the United States from even allowing us to buy medicine with our own money. Well, whatever the Americans are saying about their sanctions not affecting humanitarian items is just a lie. We have been trying to transfer money for the COVID-19 COVAX, the WHO vaccine. We haven't been able to do that. We've been trying to transfer money even for normal influenza vaccines, where the United States restrictions prevent us from even transferring money to buy vaccines. So it's basically medical terrorism that the U.S. is engaged in.
Now, you're now in Moscow for what I assume some sensitive conversations, since you came here in person, and I'm pretty sure that you are going to touch with your Russian colleagues on the latest U.S. decision to reimpose arms embargo against your country. Now, everybody except the United States agrees that it's illegal, so we don't have to waste your valuable time on talking about the illegitimacy of that act. I want to ask you, and I want to get an honest assessment from you, whether you think it could still be effective despite being illegal. Does the United States have the means of imposing, not only imposing that ban on your country, but effectively making it international?
Well, the United States does certainly have a lot of might, financial might, in when it comes to preventing countries from dealing with each other. And that is why countries are less and less dependent on dollar, because they know that as long as they depend for their international transaction on US dollars, they are basically at the mercy of the United States, and the Americans can impose their whims on them. Second point on this is, this is a principle for us. Iran doesn't buy a lot of arms. We're not Saudi Arabia. I mean, they spent $67 billion, more than Russia did, on their military. We don't spend that much money. We don't have that much money to spend. We produce most of the weapons we need ourselves. So we're not going to go to international markets to try to procure weapons from here and there. None of the European countries even sold us weapons since the revolution. So we're not under any illusions. But this is a principle, that there was an agreement to lift the restrictions. And as Russia correctly has pointed out, we were not under an arms embargo. There were restrictions. We needed to get a permission from the Security Council to buy and sell weapons. And now that restriction will be lifted in mid-October. And that is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. If we need to procure weapons, to buy weapons from our friends, then there are no legal limits.
Well, speaking of your friends and buying arms from that, when your Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov was asked whether Russian arms producers will continue trading with Iran, he said that he could not give an answer because it's a private business decision and the Americans do have an ability to influence the calculus of risks. I want to ask you specifically what kind of reaction you're expecting from Russia and China. Is the rhetorical condemnation enough?
Well, Russia and China took the lead in objecting to the American measures, but for that matter, even the Europeans. I mean, 13 of the 15 Security Council members twice wrote letters to the president of the Security Council, once on the 20th of August when the United States issued its so-called notification, and once on the 20th of September when the United States claimed that its purported UN sanctions have come back, rejecting it. And that's what's important. I think that's the important point.
Just a diplomatic stance, you know, is enough.
But yeah, I mean, that's a major diplomatic defeat for the United States, isolation of the United States, verification by the international community of the legitimacy of Iranian position, which is an important achievement, not just for Iran, but for the international community and for the rule of law. Now, we have contacts at the military level with our friends. Those contacts will continue. And usually these are not broadcast live on television.
Mm-hmm, I see. You mentioned the European reaction, and I do want to ask you about the Europeans, because I think Russia nowadays finds itself in a situation similar to the one that Iran was with the JCPOA, because it has invested in a pipeline, in the Nord Stream pipeline, and now it sees the Europeans having second thoughts or paying lip service to certain ideas without actually putting any muscle behind it. Can the Europeans still be regarded as this reasonable part of the West? Because they definitely talk a different talk from the United States, but are they more reliable when it comes to international agreements and keeping their word?
Well, as you just correctly pointed out, Nord Stream is a very clear example that if Europeans allow the United States to bully them when it comes to Iran, the United States can bully them when it comes to their lifeline. And Nord Stream is extremely important for Europe, as you know. For Germany, it's most reliable energy source. And the United States is even trying to clearly intimidate Germany from engaging with Russia in that. So I think the lesson that has to be drawn from that is that if you allow a bully to operate, then there is no limit, no end. And I think the Europeans need to realize that. Now, unfortunately, up until now, Europeans have been doing a lot of good talk on JCPOA, on the Nord Stream, but not much action. I think, we have a long history, and we are patient. We know that the policy of the United States, the bullying policy of the United States, is bound to be rejected by the international community.
Well,
takes some time, but we have thousands of years of history. We're not like some countries with 250 years.
Well, I wish I had this long view of history and this kind of optimism, but for the time being, we have to take a short break. So we'll be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the CPR News from CommunityPublicRadio.org.
There's a bit more than a month left until the next U.S. presidential elections. I know that you say that Iran doesn't have a preferred candidate, but as a country with a long tradition of strategic analysis, I'm sure you have to foresee different scenarios. Do you think there will be a difference in the U.S. policy vis-a-vis your country depending on who occupies the White House come next year?
Well, obviously, there will be differences between various presidents and various points of views. I doubt that anyone will have extreme views such as President Trump. But at the end of the day, we need to look at the policy, not the personality in the White House. Now, I think the question that needs to be asked before even asking what their policy will be with regard to Iran is whether there will be a peaceful transition in the United States if Vice President Biden wins the election. From what we heard from President Trump yesterday, there seems to be a bit more complicated scenarios ahead of us.
His diplomatic contenders are also pretty unsure whether they're going to accept his victory. So I think it plays for both camps, perhaps.
Well, let's wait and see. I mean, the other camp doesn't have many options. President Trump is sitting in the White House. And for a sitting president to claim that his country's elections are going to be rigged, it's an interesting scenario to watch.
Now, his contender, or his competitor rather, Joe Biden, has already indicated that if he wins, his administration is willing to resurrect the JCPOA, to which your country and you personally responded by rolling out preconditions, rebuilding trust, compensating the damages, which I'm sure you know are non-starters. What I want to ask you is, regardless of your feelings about the U.S. conduct, is Iran interested in the covenants of the deal? Are you interested in its substance?
Oh, of course we are. We have said that with or without the United States, if Iranian interests that are guaranteed in the JCPOA, we don't want anything outside the JCPOA. We simply want what is ours, what was bargained, what was negotiated within the JCPOA, and it cannot be renegotiated. We simply want that. If the remaining JCPOA participants can provide that, we are willing to live with that. We gave them, particularly the Europeans, over a year to implement what they had promised. They made 11 promises at the level of foreign ministers twice to us. But they were not able to even start implementing those 11 promises, not even a single one of them. And then we started reducing our commitments to JCPOA, as was foreseen in the JCPOA. So that's the real dispute resolution mechanism, not the parallel world dispute resolution mechanism that the United States is talking about. We are abiding by our obligations. We are within the JCPOA. And if the Europeans come back to JCPOA and implement their obligations, then it's fine. JCPOA is alive. The Security Council proved that it is alive. the United States tried to torpedo this resolution. We were sitting in a room. The United States not only left the room, but bombed the room, tried to destroy the room. Now it has to gain a seat back in the room. And that is not automatic. I'm not putting any preconditions. I mean, you do not want to have a situation in international environment where somebody can leave an agreement at will and come back to it at will. This doesn't work.
I was watching your conversation at the Council of Foreign Relations, and you repeated this wonderful Persian saying a few times. First you prove your brotherhood, then ask for inheritance. And as wise as it may be, the Americans, let alone Trump, don't live by Persian wisdom. They have their own philosophy, and for the time being, it's a philosophy of taking what they think is theirs by force.
No, their philosophy is what's mine is mine, what's yours is negotiable.
Absolutely.
That's not, that's not the philosophy that I'm willing to succumb to.
You may not be willing to succumb to, but how do you think, what is the effective way of dealing with it? Because whether you like it or not, you still have to live in a world where this philosophy, you know, leaves a significant mark.
Well, I think Iran, Russia, and a good number of other states are not prepared to allow this philosophy to become the ruling philosophy. We believe in the rule of law. We believe in the prevalence of international norms. We believe that you, when you sign a treaty, you need to abide by it. These are what we believe in. Otherwise, we will have the law of the jungle.
We can operate like that between ourselves, but what about dealing with the United States?
We need to. Otherwise, it will be a jungle, and we're not prepared to live in a jungle.
So,
and I don't think Russia is prepared to live in a jungle. I don't think China is prepared. And I think gradually Europe will stop accepting these diktats from Washington.
Switching gears a little bit because our time is running out. I know that you said before that you are not very impressed by the recent agreement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, as well as Bahrain, on the establishment of full diplomatic ties. Why not?
Should I be? Well, they've had very, very strategic secret connections for the past 15 years. The Israeli ambassador in Washington, I mean, put on Twitter his picture with Youssef Al-Otaiba, the UAE ambassador, and said, I'm now happy that I can share with you a friendship that we've had for a long time. So it was a friendship that they've had for a long time. Now they had a photo opportunity in the White House to help Trump get reelected in Florida. That may serve that purpose, but it doesn't serve peace.
But, Minister, personal or professional connection is one thing. A fully-fledged state relationship is something else.
No, there were state relationships. There were state relationships. These relationships were kept secret. Now they decided under Trump's son-in-law pressure to make it public in order to help Trump, to give him a diplomatic victory that he needed with his dismal record of foreign affairs so that he could show something.
But it's not only about Trump, because Israel is now offering its newly found Arab friends new technology, vital technology, investment opportunities. This deal also clears the way for the United States to sell more weapons to countries in your region. Is that really that irrelevant for the interests of Iran?
Well,
Aren't you minimizing the impact of that agreement on your own position?
I'm not minimizing the impact. I'm saying that this was a travesty of justice to the Palestinians, but it wasn't a major diplomatic accomplishment. These countries buy, Persian Gulf countries, buy 25% of total global weaponry.
And they will buy more.
I mean, what have they done with this 25% of total global weaponry that they can? I mean, let's make it 30, let's make it 40, let's make it 50. What good does it do them?
So it doesn't bother you at all?
Well, it does bother me that our neighbors are trying to buy security. They have been trying to buy security. Don't forget, they tried to buy security from Saddam Hussein. And look where they got with him. They tried to buy security from the United States, and they saw the United States simply just leaving them in the cold without giving them any protection. Now they're trying to buy security from Israel, which cannot even protect itself against Palestinians. Now, I think they're badly mistaken. They need to look inward. Mm-hmm. They need to look at their own people for legitimacy, and they need to look at their own neighborhood for security.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are lots of speculations of who is going to be next. Amman and Sudan are talked about as the next countries to follow in the footsteps of the UAE. But everybody is definitely looking at the Saudi Arabia. And I think you can see some subtle signs that the public opinion is being massaged for the formalization of
what
Israelis.
Is already there.
Yeah.
For the formalization of what is already there.
Yes.
I mean, Saudi Arabia and Israel have been cooperating with each
exactly.
other for years.
And doing that in the open. Do you think that's a likely scenario of it actually happening?
I don't think it's important. I don't think it's important. I don't think it affects the situation. What is important is that, I mean, they never helped the Palestinians anyway.
But we're not talking about only Palestinians.
No, it does. I mean, the entire problem in the Middle East is the trampling of the rights of the Palestinian people. You need to measure any development with that yardstick, whether it affects the struggle, the resistance of the Palestinians towards continued occupation. I do not think Saudi Arabia, UAE, or Bahrain were strong supporters of the Palestinian cause other than lip service. So I don't think it will have any practical impact on the difficulties in our region. The difficulty in our region is because of expansionism, of aggression, and of violation of the rights of the Palestinian people.
Now, President Trump likes to compliment himself on his new approaches to diplomacy, and both his Israeli and Arab colleagues are willing to give him that. I mean, they're willing to give him praise, the photo ops, while securing their own interests, because I think they're not losing out there. I know that Iranians are proud people, but there is also a certain degree of satisfaction in taking your enemy for a ride. Trump wants a deal with Iran. You know that, I know that, everybody knows that. Why not let him having it on your terms?
There is a principle that you want a deal that is not a photo opportunity. We have 159 pages of a deal. It's not a two-page document that he can show in front of cameras. And I think it is in everybody's interest. I'm not saying it is only in our interest or only in U.S. interest. It's a deal. It doesn't have everything that we wanted. It doesn't have everything that the United States wanted. Otherwise, it would have been an instrument of surrender by Iran or by the United States. Well, you cannot expect the United States to surrender. He says that he cannot expect Iran to surrender. So I think President Trump had what he needs. He wants to call it Trump deal, call it Trump deal. But it is the best that can be achieved.
Now, this is
and
what...
I'm not going to risk something that I negotiated. I know how hard it is. I'm not just willing to allow something that was extremely difficult to negotiate to evaporate just in order to satisfy somebody's ego.
But Minister, with all due respect, my question is not so much about the Americans, but about the Israelis and the Emiratis. Do you think it's a good strategy? Do you think it's a clever policy of securing your country's interest while giving your partner or adversary something that he wants? And at the end of the day, a photo op, as you said, is not that big of a price for securing and getting what you want. Why doesn't Iran try something like that?
I don't speak for Israel, but I certainly don't believe that the United Arab Emirates got what they require, what they need, what their people need. Had they gotten a bit of that...
They've been promised a lot, you know?
Oh, well, promises are promises. Promises are words of mouth.
You don't think that Israel will pursue that, sharing technologies, giving opportunities, wooing Arab neighbors into their orbit?
Well, Israel...
I'm sure you believe that they will do that, the Israelis.
Yeah, well, come on. Israel has said that with our talent and their money, we can get a lot. I mean, are they willing to take that? Are they willing to buy that?
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.